Thank you, Connie, for those very kind words. Good to be here this morning and to see each of you. Appreciate the invitation to be a part of the program this year. It's always a delight to come back to Bowling Green and see friends in this area, and to be a part of this program is also a treat. I'll have to warn you, I am starved to death, and so if you hear my stomach growl through the PA system in just a little while, just be kind about that and ignore it. I didn't get a sausage biscuit, Greg, wherever you've gotten off to, and so my stomach is growling. Have so much enjoyed hearing Dan's and Greg's wonderful remarks on two of the great themes in the Bible, the Abrahamic and Davidic covenants. We're turning our attention now to the book of Job, if you would like to go ahead and turn there in your Bibles. We're going to look at a passage in the 19th chapter of Job, very familiar to almost all of us, I'm sure, where Job says that he knew that his Redeemer lived. The book of Job, of course, has to do with what we sometimes call the problem of pain. And that's a problem of universal concern, isn't it? Pain touches everybody's lives at some point or another. And the problem of pain is not just a philosophical problem. It's not just a theoretical point to think about and talk about. When real suffering enters our lives, as it almost always does in the case of most of us, we cry out for relief. And when relief doesn't come, we cry out for an explanation. Maybe our means of making a living is taken away from us. A child dies a tragic death. We learn maybe that we have a terminal illness. A family member leaves the Lord and plunges into a life of sin and worldliness. And any number of other things can go wrong. And when hardships like that happen, as they do in the real world, they tear our hearts apart. And when that happens, God does not personally and specifically explain to each of us why those things are taking place and why our hearts had to be broken in such ways. And when we're faced with that kind of pain and agony, some people just leave the faith, wondering, how can there be a good God who would allow people, at least who try to do the right thing, to suffer in these kinds of ways? Well, there's no book in the Bible that speaks to the issue of unexplained suffering any more than the book of Job. And I don't believe there's any passage in Job that speaks to the issue any more powerfully than chapter 19, verses 23 through 27. Verse 25, in which Job cries, "I know that my Redeemer lives, and he shall stand at last on the earth." Certainly one of the great texts in the Old Testament, isn't it? I think it's one of the greatest of the great. And if we properly understand it, and maybe more important, if we have the courage to apply it to our lives, I think Job 19:25 can be a strong part of the foundation of our faith. It really can make the difference between hope and despair. Mike asked me to mention this, and I do so reluctantly. But about 12 years ago, my wife of some years at that time decided to leave me and our two sons to pursue a life of worldliness, and left my life in shreds in many ways. And I don't know that during all of the intervening 12 years I've thought specifically about Job 19:25 all of that time, but I can surely tell you that the truth that is contained in this passage made the difference between my survival and not. The attitude that Job had when his trials were at their worst, to simply hang on and trust what he knew to be true about God, even though he couldn't see the visible evidence of that truth at that moment, and just to keep believing what he knew to be true, that God was his Redeemer and one day would do what was right, and meanwhile he would just have to hang on, that really can make a difference. And I recommend what this passage says to you this morning, not just from a theoretical standpoint, but from a very personal standpoint as well. I know we're running behind time, and so I'm going to have to abbreviate my remarks somewhat. But I want to cover three basic points in our study. I want to first of all discuss the meaning of the passage in its context. And then I want to talk with you about a couple of features that I think make the passage all the more striking. And then finally make some practical applications to our situation today. If you have turned to Job 19, let's first of all look at the meaning of the passage itself in its context. It is a great passage, but for all of its greatness, this is a hard text. There are some aspects of this passage that are hard to understand. It is hard to translate, apparently, though I'm not a translator. If you just compare even three or four translations of Job 19, you won't see any two that are very much alike. In one or two places, the Hebrew text may have been corrupted and miscopied, so that we may not even have in a word or two, the original text itself, to translate. And almost every phrase in the passage can be taken in more than one way. And you have to decide which way to take it or to assume that it may mean more than one thing at a time. So the passage needs to be handled with great care. But despite the difficulties of it, the main point is very clear. And so we want to look and see what it is plainly and truly that Job was declaring that he knew about God, that we need to know when we are undergoing some travail of suffering. In the first part of Job 19, Job had been responding to the previous discourse of his friend Bildad, who along with his other two friends, Eliphaz and Zophar, had been reasoning with him that the tribulations that had overwhelmed him were chastening for some sins that Job must have committed. They were arguing that he was being punished, and the severity of the punishment to them indicated that whatever it was Job had done must have been very terrible for such a chastening to have come upon him. But against that charge, here in Job 19, Job is maintaining his innocence. He certainly was not a perfect man, and he didn't claim to be a perfect man. But Job knew that he was what he was called in the very first couple of verses of this book, and that is a blameless man. It is not possible for us in this world to be perfect, but it is possible to be blameless, to be a godly person. Chapter 1 and verse 1 describes him as blameless and upright and one who feared God and shunned evil. Job knew that about himself. He didn't know what the reason for his sufferings were, but he knew one thing that it was not, and that was the sinfulness that his friends were falsely attributing to him. So at this point, Job's argument would be something like this: I'm suffering horribly. God, who could have at least kept this from happening, is ultimately responsible, but I don't know why he has chosen for me to suffer so. I see nothing about this situation from my vantage point that would make it anything less than an injustice to me. And my friends, who should be standing with me, are standing against me. Such was his plea in the middle of his ordeal. But nobody seemed willing to listen or even to admit that he might be right. And so Job must have felt very alone. And he wished, as we'll see here in just a second in verse 23, that his words might be written down, so that maybe later, after he was dead and gone, somebody would remember what he had maintained about his innocence, and the evidence would be clear enough for them to see maybe then. So in verses 23 and 24, Job says, "Oh, that my words were written, that they were inscribed in a book, that they were engraved on a rock with an iron pen and lead forever." Job makes a series of three progressively stronger statements here when he says, I want a permanent record to be made of what I'm saying here. First of all, he says, I wish it'd be written down rather than just spoken. And then it might be inscribed on a scroll, which is a more permanent record than just a sheet of scratch paper that you might use. And then he says, I wish that my words would be chiseled into stone and filled with lead. That'd be about as permanent a human record as you could make. And what he's doing here amounts to the same thing that we do when we say something and then we say to somebody, "Now you mark my words." He's saying, write this down. You may not agree with me right now. You may not see the sense in what I'm saying right now, But mark my word, the time will come when the truth of what I'm saying will become obvious and apparent. And he wouldn't have wanted a written record of his plea of innocence to be made if he thought that the future would never bring anything other than what the present was bringing for him right now. And here is where we begin to see the kind of faith that Job had that made such a difference. He was a hurting man, and his pain had made him miserable and perplexed and even angry. But even at the worst of his ordeal, Job hung on. And he reached forward to a future that he believed some way was going to be better than the present. The present made no sense to Job, but he doggedly refused to let go of a future in which there'd be some relief, however distant that future might be. And in some of the most powerful language in the Old Testament, Job gave three reasons then why he wished his words to be written down. And each of these things expresses a confidence in something that he said he knew about the future. So in verse 25, he says, I wish my words would be written down, first of all, because I know that my Redeemer lives. The first confidence that Job had was that there would be somebody who would redeem him, is the word that's used. The word Redeemer here, at least as it appears in the New King James and most other translations, is a translation of the Hebrew term Goel, which occurs very often in the Old Testament. Other possible translations would be avenger, vindicator, defender, deliverer, something like that. And the primary use of the term had to do with family law in the Old Testament. The term goel referred to the duty of a relative to protect and to defend the rights of a member of his family who had suffered some kind of difficulty or hardship. For example, if a person had to sell himself into slavery to pay his debts, why then a near relative, a goel, could redeem him from his slavery. Or if he had to sell his property to pay his debts, then a close relative, his goel, was to be given the opportunity to buy the land back so that it could be kept in the family. And in the most dramatic case, of course, had to do with murder. A kinsman was to avenge a wrongful death by killing the person who had done the thing. And he was the goel, the redeemer, the avenger. But goel could also be used of God, couldn't it? In Isaiah chapter 49 and verse 26, for example, God said to his people, I will feed those who oppress you with their own flesh, and they shall be drunk with their own blood as with sweet wine. All flesh shall know that I, the Lord, am your Savior and your Redeemer, your Goel, the Mighty One of Jacob. Jeremiah chapter 50, verse 33, this hope was given to the people who were facing Babylonian captivity. Thus says the Lord of hosts, the children of Israel were oppressed along with the children of Judah. All who took them captive have held them fast. They have refused to let them go. Their Redeemer, their Goel, is strong. The Lord of hosts is his name. And he will thoroughly plead their case, that he may give rest to the land and quiet and disquiet to the inhabitants of Babylon. So you look at all those passages, what's the basic idea of the Redeemer, the Goel? Well, the common idea is that this is a person who delivers somebody else from trouble, usually a near relative or a kinsman. Sometimes the Goel, the Redeemer, was an earthly relative, a kinsman. Sometimes it was God. Sometimes a price had to be paid to get the person out of the difficulty. Sometimes there was no price involved. But always the idea was that a redeemer comes to the aid of a loved one and solves the particular problem that that loved one had. And so in the passage that we're looking at here in Job 19, Job declares his confidence that no matter how terrible his troubles might turn out to be, he still had a redeemer, a goel, who would come to his aid and who would deal with the difficulty in some kind of a way, even if it would be in the future. Depending on what translation you're using, Redeemer may be capitalized or not. It's an open question whether Job believed God would be his Redeemer or just somebody else. The choice may not be as clear as the traditional interpretation of the passage might make it look, but I believe that the traditional interpretation is exactly correct. Verse 25 is too tightly connected to verses 25 through 27, all of which are about God, so that you can't really pull out that statement about His Redeemer from its context. In context, it has to do with God. And Job is affirming his confidence that when all is said and done, right would be done in regard to his suffering, and that the one who would take care of this would be none other than God Himself. And that is a wonderful faith to have, isn't it, when you're dealing with difficulty. But after having laid the responsibility for his suffering at God's feet in the first part of chapter 19, what sense would it make for Job then to turn around and look to that same God for his redemption and his vindication? Well, here I believe we can learn something about the honesty and the real faith that Job had. First of all, real faith is based upon evidence, isn't it? Real faith is not a blind leap in the dark. It's based upon reason to have confidence in somebody. Remember at the end of the book, Job will say to the Lord, I have heard of you by the hearing of the ear. Job had heard testimony, maybe when he was even a child, about the things God had done that were of a trustworthy nature. And so Job had confidence in the trustworthiness of God. Even though things were happening at that moment that might call that into question, Job's faith was based upon evidence that had already been placed upon record. But second, with that kind of a faith, Job could look beyond the confusing circumstances that surrounded him at that particular moment. No matter how much long-term, large perspective evidence we may have for the existence of God and His goodness, you and I both know that immediate circumstances can hide that evidence from us, can't it? At least it can make us forget about what we know of God's proven trustworthiness. At night, for example, there's not any immediate evidence that there's any such thing as daylight. But it'd be a fool, wouldn't it, at night to quit believing in daylight just because there wasn't any evidence for it right at that moment. When it's dark, you know, an unbeliever might mock and say, well, where's the evidence for your daylight now? And a believer would have to answer, well, there is any evidence right now. But there's been some evidence already placed on record that there is such a thing as daylight, and I'm not going to forget that at this dark moment. Past evidence doesn't suddenly cease to exist when some moment arrives containing questions that we might not be able to answer right then. So Job was more honest than a lot of us about the unanswerability of the questions that surrounded him. He didn't know why he was suffering. And he refused to sugarcoat those questions with just pious platitudes. He pressed the issue of the seeming unfairness. I stress the seeming unfairness of what was happening to him. And for what he could see at that moment, there was no acceptable reason why he should be suffering. And he spoke about that with extreme frankness. Mike Willis and I were talking over breakfast one morning several months ago about how frank Job was in this book. You just read the whole book sometime from start to finish in one reading. Job spoke very frankly about the fact that from what he could see at that point, none of this made sense. But that didn't mean that he still didn't remember that God had already placed on record sufficient evidence of his trustworthiness. And so at the very same time that Job is pressing the issue with God, this is not fair, he's able to remember that God somehow, some way will be his Redeemer, and at the same time to say, I know that my Redeemer lives. It's as if he was saying, God, You've struck me for no good reason that I can see. And also very reverently say, God, your reasoning is beyond all earthly reason, and I rest my hopes on you. I trust that you are my Redeemer, my near kinsman, who will someday do what's right about whatever is wrong. And so in the latter part of verse 25, having said that he knew his Redeemer lived, he said, he shall stand at last on the earth. The second confidence that Job has was that his Redeemer would have the last say. When he talks about standing on the earth, he's using legal terminology. This is an expression that refers to a witness standing up in court to set the record straight. And the Revised English Bible, I think, translates this verse aptly when it says, "I know that my vindicator lives and that he will rise last to speak in court." That's the image. And that's consistent with the role of the goel, who would defend the legal cause of a person who had suffered. In Proverbs 23, for example, verses 10 and 11, we read this, "Do not remove the ancient landmark, nor enter the fields of the fatherless, for their Redeemer is mighty, and He will plead their cause against you." What's the point? Don't do wrong to another human being, because that person has a Redeemer, and that person will stand up last in court and set the record straight, and then where will you be? Job was confident that God would do that for him. When all of the other witnesses had had their say, God would take the stand. We need to understand that. History has its ups and downs. And boy, the downs can be pretty down sometimes, can't they? But God will have the last say. And when that time comes, the truth will be known. And right will be done about whatever wrongs have transpired. And so then in verse 26, he said, "After my skin is destroyed, this I know, that in my flesh I shall see God, whom I shall see for myself, and my eyes shall behold, and not another, how my heart yearns within me." The third confidence that Job had was that the time would come when he would see God. This part of the passage, these two verses there in 26 and 27, are... those verses are notoriously difficult. To illustrate just how differently the various translations handle those verses, just compare the King James with the American Standard. King James says, "And though after my skin worms destroy this body, yet in my flesh shall I see God, whom I shall see for myself, and mine eyes shall behold, and not another." American Standard says, "And after my skin even this body is destroyed, then without my flesh shall I see God, whom I, even I, shall see on my side, and mine eyes shall behold, and not as a stranger." Well, those are two very different renderings. And if you check other translations, you'd see even more differences. Don't have time to go into all of the details, the difficulty of those two verses. But I believe, all things considered, the New King James actually has done about the best job of negotiating all of the translational difficulties of that passage. And here's how the New King James says it. Read it to you again. "After my skin is destroyed," that would surely refer to his physical body, "this I know, that in my flesh I shall see God, whom I shall see for myself, and my eyes shall behold, and not another." But can Job really be saying what he seems to be saying in those words? So far back in Old Testament history, and there are many who would say that Job is the first book in the Old Testament to be written, that far back, could Job really be expressing what would amount to a faith in the bodily resurrection after death? Well, time won't permit us to talk about that very much. But again, I personally believe that this passage really does contain one of the earliest references in the Bible to a bodily resurrection. Now, Job might not have known what we know about the resurrection. Surely he didn't. And when he spoke of seeing God in his flesh, he may have spoken more truth than he knew. Now, sometimes it's possible to say more than even you knew might have been in your words. Even so, I think Job seems to have believed that somehow, some way, the time would come when, after his present body had been destroyed, that he would have some kind of a body in which he would see God. A Living Bible, which I hesitate to recommend, but they got it right in this passage, says, "I know that after this body has decayed, this body shall see God." Well, that sounds contradictory, doesn't it? But that's exactly what the doctrine of the bodily resurrection asks us to believe. We die before the Lord returns, then the body in which we now live will decompose and our spirits will go back to the God who gave them. But at the resurrection, our bodies no less, will be raised. They'll be changed into glorious bodies that are no longer corruptible or mortal. But they'll still be our bodies in which we will see God. And so Job 19:26 and 27 may be hard to translate, but despite the difficulties of translation, the clear emphasis of the passage is this. Job expected to see God. And he had what David had, and Abraham had, and all the great fathers of the faith had. Listen to me. Job had a determined confidence that death would not break off a communion with God which had begun in this life. That it would continue. And in his flesh, he would see God. And so at the very end of verse 27, in view of all of that, he simply says, "How my heart yearns within me." The thought of seeing God was almost more than Job could bear, especially in his present pain. As Ellison said, he nearly swooned at the thought, "How my heart yearns within me." To actually see the God who would redeem him and vindicate his cause was more than a mere preference. It was a heart-wrenching passion. And so it needs to be with us, my friends. It's not just something to think about. This is something that, if true, can do no less than take hold of our hearts and be the passion that keeps us going when nothing else will. But quickly, I think there are a couple of factors that make this passage even more impressive than we've already seen it to be. When you think, first of all, about the fact that Job, though he was a godly man, a man of godly integrity, was a man who had some serious questions about God. We sometimes do with Job 19:25 what we do with a lot of other passages. We pull it out of context and we just read Job saying, "I know that my Redeemer lives." And we say, "Well, I wish I could have that buoyant, optimistic faith of Job when I was suffering like he was suffering." Well, Job 19, if you read the chapter, is one of the blackest chapters in the Bible. When Job says, "I know that my Redeemer lives," he's not speaking as a man who doesn't have any questions or any doubts. He's saying that despite his questions and his doubts. What was happening to him made no sense at all. But he was saying what Abraham had said in Genesis when Abraham pressed God about doing the right thing and said, "Shall not the judge of all the earth do what's right?" We need to understand that the solid foundations of our faith will sometimes be hidden from us. Listen. There'll be too many tears in our eyes sometimes to see the evidence that has been so plain in the past. That doesn't mean that faith is any less an option at those times when our tears have blurred our vision. Real faith doesn't mean never having any questions. It means doing what Job did. Hanging on in the darkness to evidence that we remember having seen while the sun was still shining. And just having the dogged cussedness not to give up despite our questions and our doubts. Out of the muck and the mire to hold on for dear life to the truth that God is God. Whether we feel like it or not. There'll be times when our faith will be easy. But there'll be times when faith will be no more than sheer dogged determination to gut it out and to hang on. And against all reason that we can see from our straitened circumstances, we've got to be willing to say what Job said, having heard the testimony of God in the past, "I know that my Redeemer lives." And he didn't say that as a man who didn't have any doubt. He had serious doubts, but he still knew he had a Redeemer. I'll tell you something else that makes that passage all the more striking, and that is that Job was a godly man. You say, "Well, sure, he was a godly man, but what's the point about that?" Put yourself in Job's friend's position. You wouldn't want to be somebody that the things that were happening to Job would happen to you. And so it would have been very convenient for Job's friends to prove that this was happening to Job because he was a wicked man. And that might have let them off the hook. They might have said, well, you know, as long as I keep from being as bad a man as Job is, then these kind of things won't happen to me. But that wasn't the truth. These kinds of things were happening to a godly man. And if they can happen to a Job, they can happen to anybody. Listen to me. It is simply not true that godly people will have no heartaches in this world. In fact, Job's sufferings came upon him because he was a godly man. It was the whole test. And if such things befell a man like Job, are any of us exempt? Are we being anything but naive if we think we're going to somehow get through this life without hurting and grieving and being tested? When we have given the Lord our best and still our hearts are broken, Peter would say to us, do not think it strange. What were you expecting in a world like this? It's a world of travail. This world is broken. Irretrievably broken. The Lord doesn't intend to fix it and just put a lot more happiness here. He intends to destroy it. Build a new heavens and a new earth in which righteousness dwells. As long as we live in this world, we ought not to be surprised, even as people who do our best to serve the Lord, that bad things happen to folks like Job and to folks like us. But finally, and quickly, four personal and specific applications to our situation today. Number one, I suggest that we learn from this passage that it's not wrong to do what Job did here, and that is to long to have your cause vindicated. Job was being mistreated by his friends. They weren't doing right by him even in the way they were going about consoling him. They were doing an injustice to him by accusing him of having committed sins that Job knew he didn't commit. And Job cried out to the Lord to deal with these friends. They were doing what wasn't right. It's not wrong to cry out to God to do what's right about wrongs that have happened when we've suffered. David, in the imprecatory Psalms, frequently voiced similar sentiments in regard to pleading with God to do what was right about the mistreatment that he had suffered at the hands of others. In the New Testament, Paul wrote to the Thessalonians, it is a righteous thing, a just thing, with God to repay with tribulation those who trouble you. 2 Thessalonians 1, 6 through 8. And in the revelation given to John, those who had been slain for the word of God cried with a loud voice saying, how long, O Lord, holy and true, until you judge and avenge our blood on those who dwell on the earth? How long, O Lord, before you do that? Admittedly, when you pray to God to avenge your blood and blast your enemies and give them what they've got coming to them, that's a dangerous prayer. It can be prayed, but it's a dangerous prayer. Not many of us can pray that without being hypocrites or without letting unworthy sentiments like anger enter into it. But in theory, it'd be right for a godly person to cry out for God to do what's right about the wrongs that he suffered. Number two, it is possible to have the kind of integrity that Job had. Now, I want you to understand that. You said in the beginning, Job was not a perfect man, but he was a blameless man. It's possible to be what the Bible calls blameless. That doesn't mean sinlessly perfect. It means to be the kind of person against whom, if some charge is going to be made, it wouldn't be anything other than just the common foibles that everybody's prone to. And we can be that, folks. It's high time we understood that a godly, faithful life is possible. It was so even before the coming of Christ, as evidenced by the commendation of Zacharias and Elizabeth, John the Baptist's parents. Remember what it was said about them? They were both righteous before God, walking in all the commandments and ordinances of the Lord, blameless. They did it. We can too. J. Job did it. We need to understand it's possible to be godly people. And I'll tell you the excuse, well, I'm only human. It's not an expression of humility, usually. It's an excuse for irresponsibility very often. And we need to quit making excuses and get busy living the kind of life that Job lived. And Enoch, and Abraham, and Daniel, and so many others. We need to build the kind of record that could be defended as steadfastly as Job was able to defend his integrity. That's doable. Even by folks like you and me. But number three, listen to this one now. Don't forget the point we've just made, but listen to this next one. We need to be honest enough to see when our integrity is not what Job's was. Job was right, and his enemies were wrong. When you read those passages, don't assume that you're in Job's position. You may be in Job's friend's position. Before we get carried away defending our blamelessness and our integrity like Job, calling upon God to vindicate our cause against our enemies, we need to consider that in our case, God might say our enemies were in the right. We may be the ones who were in the wrong. We always assume our rightness, don't we, in any controversy. We assume I'm in the right, and God, would you just please deal with these wicked enemies of mine? Sometimes that might not be the case. When the everlasting judge considers all the evidence and gives his perfect judgment in every controversy, those of us who have called loudly for justice may find that what we need is not justice, but a whole lot of mercy. We get big into wanting other people to get what's coming to them. The Lord said, by the same measure, it'll be measured to you. If you're into justice, then you're going to get justice. Maybe when you'd want mercy. So while it's possible to be in Job's position and know that we've been mistreated, it takes a person of above average honesty, I suggest, to see when that's true and when it's not. You remember the people in Malachi's day, don't you? They were longing for the day of the Lord to come and blast these wicked people away. And the prophet said, well, the Lord is coming. The Lord whom you seek will come into His temple, even the messenger of the covenant in whom you delight, because you think He's going to punish the wicked. He's coming, says the Lord of hosts. But the prophet added, who can endure the day of His coming, and who can stand when He appears? Let me tell you, the day of justice will be a fearful day, no less for many churchgoers than for the atheists and the apostates. But finally, let me say that Job said, I know that my Redeemer lives. There just has to be a Redeemer. There's just a whole lot about the world as it stands today that doesn't make any moral sense. It just doesn't add up. The world is full of suffering. And much of it is suffered by people who have done nothing to bring it upon themselves. In short, much of what happens in this world is wrong. And it requires vindication. And we may bear it for now, in the hope that justice will be done later. But if there never is to be any vindication at all, then what you'd have to say is that this life is worse than no life at all. There must be a Redeemer at last to stand upon the earth, or else life is absurd and meaningless. There's no in between. There's no safe middle ground. And if there is not a Redeemer, then we're in a heap of trouble. Because there is much about this world that is wrong that cries out for someone to set the record straight and do what's right. So finally, let me wrap up these remarks. The hope of the gospel of Christ is that there is a Redeemer. That's what the gospel is about. A Redeemer who will stand up and do what's right about every wrong that has ever been perpetrated. Job couldn't have known much of what we know about the kind of redemption Christ would accomplish, but Job didn't really need to know the details. He simply needed to trust, as he surely did, based upon evidence that had been placed on record by God, that at some point in the future, God would act on behalf of those who've been faithful to Him. And that was Job's confidence. Listen, folks, God has placed monumental evidence on record, above all in the resurrection of His Son, that He can be trusted. And He asks us, the Hebrew writer says in Hebrews 11 and verse 6, to believe two things about God. To hang on to two things about God when it seems right now that you just can't see how that's true right now. Number one, that He is, His existence, and that He is a rewarder of those who diligently seek Him. That He's a benevolent, good God. There'll be days when it'll be hard for you to hang on to either of those things. But you've got to hang on, like Job did. To trust that God is and that He is a good God. And He asks us not only to believe those things intellectually, but to be confident of them, to entrust ourselves to Him when we are suffering. And oh, how we need to learn the meaning of entrusting ourselves to God. How we need to be able to say what Paul said. For this reason I also suffer these things. Nevertheless, I am not ashamed, for I know whom I have believed. And then persuaded that He is able to keep what I have committed to Him until that day. And how we need to do what Peter said. Therefore, let those who suffer according to the will of God commit their souls to Him in doing good as to a faithful Creator. I repeat, freedom from suffering is not in this world. It wasn't for Job. And it wasn't for the Lord Himself while He lived here. This world will never again be what it was before sin had done its damage. And to live in this broken world is to be hurt quite frequently. The Lord lived perfectly in this world. He never so much as even used poor judgment. But that didn't keep Him from suffering. And living as His people won't keep us from suffering either. So our expectations of life in this world shouldn't be too high, should they? There are going to be some moments of happiness, and we're grateful for them, aren't we? But we shouldn't really expect that to be the norm. We know, Paul said in Romans 8, that the whole creation groans and labors with birth pangs together until now. Not only that, but we also who have the first fruits of the Spirit, even we ourselves groan within ourselves, eagerly waiting for the adoption, the redemption of our body. For we were saved in this hope, and hope that is seen is not hope. For why does one still hope for what he sees? But if we hope for what we do not see, we eagerly wait for it with perseverance. So in the here and now, we're going to hurt. And we're going to groan when we hurt, like Job did. And may I say to you that if we ever quit groaning, the devil has got us. Most of us will need some kind of a thorn in the flesh to keep us from getting too comfortable this side of heaven. And our thorns may not be any more comfortable than Job's boils. And when we cry for relief, God's answer may be what it has often been for people who have cried out to Him, not yet. Hold on a little while longer. If our attitude is what it ought to be, we'll think about that as Paul did. We won't look upon it as an unpleasant necessity. We'll be thankful for what we learn from that. Anything that pries our grip loose from this world is something to be thankful for. Concerning this thing, Paul said, I pleaded with the Lord three times that it might depart from me, and He said, My grace is sufficient for you, for my strength is made perfect in weakness. Therefore, most gladly, I will rather boast in my infirmities, that the power of Christ may rest upon me. Therefore, I take pleasure in infirmities, in reproaches, in needs, in persecutions, in distresses, for Christ's sake. For when I am weak, then am I strong. God doesn't plan to renovate this world and take all the pain out of it for Christians. He plans to destroy it and give us a new heavens and earth in which righteousness dwells. And until that time comes, we just need to be prepared to suffer and think it not strange when we do. Our hope must not be in the betterment of this world, Now, I fear greatly that we sometimes think that that's the way it's supposed to be. We preach against the social gospelers and turn right around and think that the purpose of being a Christian is just to have a better life in this world and to be happier. And that's not what it's about. Our hope can't be in the betterment of this world, whether by our own or anyone else's efforts, but in Christ's ability to overcome this world. These things I have spoken to you, that in me you may have peace, he said to the apostles. In the world you will have tribulation, but be of good cheer. I have overcome the world. So when we find ourselves in some predicament like Job's, even if to a smaller extent, the thing that will get us through is the same kind of grit that he had. That's the best way I know to describe it. The same kind of grit that he had. The same determination not to give up. The same through-it-all faith that somehow, at some time, God will settle every account. It's the kind of faith that was pictured so powerfully in the words of Maltby Babcock's great hymn, "This is my Father's world." This is my Father's world. Oh, let me ne'er forget that though the wrong oft seems so strong, God is the ruler yet. So we hear Job say, "Oh, that my words were written, that they were transcribed in a book, that they were engraved on a rock with an iron pen and lead forever. For I know that my Redeemer lives, and he shall stand at last on the earth. And after my skin is destroyed, this I know, that in my flesh I shall see God, whom I shall see for myself, and my eyes shall behold and not another. How my heart yearns within me." Thank you for listening this morning.